Welcome, Shire dwellers, to episode 84 of the Nerdstravaganza podcast, where we pride ourselves on being faithful to the source material. I'm Tom.
I'm Brian.
And tonight we'll be discussing the second in the three-film adaptation of Tolkien's classic tale, The Hobbit. But before we launch into our lengthy and no doubt exhaustive discussion of that movie, we should launch into a somewhat less lengthy but no less exhaustive discussion of this week's happenings in our geeky lives with our usual weekly geekly roundup. Brian, you go first. What have you been up to?
Man, it was a tabletop-tastic week for me. I played Food Machine, which if you don't know about that, well, you know about that. If our listener doesn't know about that, it's a War Machine for charity. War Machine food drive, and I hadn't played War Machine in a long time, and I forgot how fun that was. I had a lot of fun at that.
Yeah, for our listeners that don't know, War Machine is a cool miniatures tabletop game, and I have to agree with you. I had fun with that as well. I hadn't played it in probably a couple years, and got to play at the charity event at the Adventure Game Store. It was pretty fun, man.
And after, well, immediately after that, you were there for that. I conducted my last transaction with GameStop ever, which I'm pretty excited about. I gotta admit,
you're excited to be free from the GameStopian sphere of influence.
Yeah, I've hated that company for years, ever since they started getting exclusives, I've been struggling with it because some of their exclusive content is really tempting, but I just truly and wholly believe that company is bad for the gaming market.
Mm.
And I hate peanut butter on my disc.
You like dried blood and peanut butter on your used games?
No.
Well, I hate to break it to you, but in purchasing your Christmas gift, I may have sucked you back into the GameStop world, depending on whether or not you need to return it. So
hopefully I'll return it to like Walmart or something like that, because they're so much less evil.
Yeah, pull a scam by going to virtuous, righteous Walmart. Or very leaky, security flawed Target, if you prefer.
And then Thursday night, I had much more fun on the tabletop topic, playing a Star Wars X-Wing miniatures game. Is that what they call it? X-Wing minis?
Yeah, sure.
That was fun. I tried my buffer DPSer list again, and I had a little bit more success this time. I didn't just immediately die in a horrible cloud of puff like before. And finally, I just in looking at miniatures and at painting techniques, I found this new game that I'm going to rope you into as soon as you're willing. Have you ever heard of Anima Tactics?
I don't think I have.
It looks really sweet. The figures are amazing. I don't know how the game plays. I haven't played it yet, but I'm interested in that. I'm going to be playing that.
I'd be willing to check it out.
Maybe it'll be on your Geekly Weekly one day.
Whoa. Maybe. We'll see. That's how things tend to happen. They happen, and then they end up on the Weekly Geekly Roundup. Anything else, sir?
Well, except for the point of our entire show, no, not so much.
Yes, we'll be getting to that shortly. Let me regale our guest with my exciting life happenings during the last week. I've been at Disney, actually, for most of the week. I took a little mini vacation up there and went to Hollywood Studios and Animal Kingdom and Epcot and the Magic Kingdom, and even popped over to Universal Studios on the way home to check out, the entire park of Islands of Adventure, and as well the Wizarding World of Harry Potter. And had a great time. I figured out why I like the theme parks. It's like being in a video game setting in real life. I mean, I enjoy just being there, even if I'm not riding rides, just strolling around. I've just got a big grin on my face the whole time.
It's difficult to be unhappy there, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. You've really got to go out of your way to be unhappy. I mean, even when things like didn't go my way, like when I was there solo, and they would cram me onto like a ride next to like some sniveling brats or something, even though I requested a little bit of space, The disappointment would last all of like 2 seconds. Like, you know what? This is disappointed as far as Disney goes, which is really not that bad.
I've been knocked down to like a 9 on the happiness scale.
Right. And then once the sniveling brat starts like oohing and aahing over the ride, you completely like are thrilled that he's having so much fun and you get over it, right? So, yeah, had a great time there. And from that and playing our regular X-Wing game, by the way, we do a weekly TIE Fightin' Thursdays event at the Adventure Game Store, in case our listeners local to our area don't know. The other thing on my agenda was The Hobbit. The Desolation of Smaug, as you are supposed to pronounce it. And I think without further ado, we can probably launch into a discussion of that film, which I know, Brian, you really held up as just a shining example of a very pure and unadulterated translation of a written work into the medium of film.
I'm a huge nerd, and I always like discussing the reality of nerdy things, and the reality of one of my favorite nerdy things, magic, is the basis that you can accept two mutually exclusive truths at the same time. And I'm able to do that with this. This was both a very good movie and the worst smoking pile of shit I almost walked out like 9 different times. And the only reason I stayed was because you kept saying, wait, it gets worse. It gets even worse than this.
Yes, I'd already seen the movie once before going to see it with you. And then I saw it one time after that. And I knew that I had the same feelings. There was the part of me that was like, you know, if this was just taken as a standalone, like just movie, this would be an awesome fantasy adventure movie. If this had just been something that was created out of whole cloth, I would have sat down and enjoyed the hell out of it. But because I know what it's based on, I've got that to deal with. And so when I went and saw it the first time, I went and saw it with people that weren't necessarily hardcore fans of Tolkien or of The Hobbit or Lord of the Rings or anything like that, and enjoyed it for it being a film. But I marked like all the points that I knew you were going to object to. And man, you delivered. I'm not a single point did you fail to guffaw, grimace, or bury your head in your hands. It was awesome.
Or at one point, completely lose my shit and scream, "What the fuck is going on?" in a crowded theater of children.
That was so funny.
Sorry,
yeah, you couldn't. Even...
Sorry, I am so sorry. I'd never do that.
It was hilarious. Yeah, I think it was at the point when like there were like ninja orcs like hopping from rooftop to rooftop in Lake Town. You were like, "What the fuck is going on here?" Oh, that was wonderful. But we'll get to that in a second. Let's start at the beginning. Let's just walk through this film and talk about let's just talk about whatever comes to mind, okay? We won't beat it up for like an hour and a half or anything, but we'll go through it fairly quickly and Get this off our chest. Let's do that. So, first of all, it starts off... Wait, are we allowed to give spoilers? Has this movie been out long enough?
I just think we have to say, basically, that this is a spoiler episode or whatever. Right. Anybody who's interested has seen it. If the book is 75 years old.
Right.
Not that that would necessarily have anything to do with the movie, but...
But if you want to see the movie that's very loosely based on the book... Obligatory spoiler alert. Here it is. Spoiler, spoilers. Run away. All right, let's do this. Okay, so the movie starts off with Thorin, the heir to the throne of Erebor, the Dwarven Kingdom, and Gandalf meeting up in the Prancing Pony Inn, coincidentally.
I'd like to interrupt just for a moment, mm-hmm. because you're kind of missing something that immediately struck me as wrong. The movie doesn't start off that way. The movie starts off with the same drunken sot that was in the fucking second movie.
Really? Sitting
drunkard in the street and belching in the camera's face.
I totally don't remember that.
And I'm 90% sure it was actually Peter Jackson. I think that was his little cameo or whatever. This is what, 80 years before the first movie? So it must have been like his grandfather or something like that doing the exact same thing in a different scene.
Either it's a family of drunks or whatever that guy's drinking preserves him for quite a long time. He's pickled.
He had the missing dwarven ring.
Could be. Okay, yes. One of the missing rings of power. But, drunken sod aside, so they meet up, and Gandalf lays out the plan to help Thorin and the other dwarves take back their lost kingdom of Erebor from the evil dragon Smaug, or Smaug, as you're supposed to pronounce it now. And that's sort of like a sort of a flashback, and then next thing you know, it flashes forward. And I think your comment to me after that 10-minute sequence was like, does anything have to do with the book yet? Because I'm kind of lost. And no sooner had you said that than it pans to Bilbo peeking his head over a ridge in the mountains and looking over at another ridge to see a bunch of warg riding orcs chasing them.
Warg.
Sorry, warg riding orcs chasing the company of dwarves. And that was the second guffaw, I think, of the night. And then the Desolation of Smaug title picks up, and then that's it. They're getting chased, and they flee and make their way to, what, Beorn's house, right?
Yeah, the Bumblebee house.
With the giant 3D Bumblebees. Now, you didn't want to watch it in 3D, but you really missed out on some huge Bumblebee 3D action flying in your face. I have to say, I really enjoyed the Beorn scene. I thought they did a good job of, like, in the book, I remember that being like, wow, what a very homey place. It's what a nice respite from the rigors of being on the road. And I thought they captured that pretty well. I guess I liked the way they did Beorn. He was this huge, sort of strange-looking dude who could shapeshift. I don't really have a lot of complaints there. How about you, apart from the 3D bees?
I really thought that was a little compressed. I felt they rushed it for the sake of squeezing in more action later on.
Yeah, I would have done with more time at Beorn's place. That was one of those places like the Tom Bombadil scene that should have been in the original trilogy that I would not have minded Jackson lavishing some major attention on. But I'm happy that this at least made the cut, unlike Tom Bombadil and Goldberry, who were cut from the original Lord of the Rings trilogy.
I thought he was well done. He looked like I thought he would.
Yeah, that brought me right back into the movie. I'm like, wow, this was really cool. I don't know about the whole him being the last of his kind and blah, 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 blah. Didn't he reap some rewards from being a participant later in the story at the end? I don't remember him being like this lonely figure who goes off to die on his own, which is what they're kind of implying here.
Well, I guess we'll see in the third movie whether he does that or not. But yeah, he definitely reappears at a pivotal point, if I remember.
Yes, he has a part still to play. So hopefully we'll be seeing more of Beorn going forward, or Beorn, or however you're supposed to pronounce it. By the way, I'm going to be making mock of the proper Tolkienic pronunciation of everything throughout this entire podcast, mainly because I resent that I have spent decades pronouncing everything wrong. So let's see, what happens next? I still have the timeline of the book in my head, and I still have a hard time reconciling that with what happened next in the film. They left Beorn's place, and he kind of shielded them, you know, to keep their, like, orc pursuers off their heels.
The woods.
Oh, yeah. They made it into Mirkwood next. Right. Okay, so far, we're not too far afield. They make it to Mirkwood, and Gandalf gets a cell phone call from Galadriel, and he has to go check out Dol Guldur, or Dol Guldur, as I've always called it, the evil fortress, which, as readers of the books will know, is the place where Sauron is re-manifesting on Middle-earth and gathering his strength again for another assault on Middle-earth in an attempt to take over. Yeah, so after getting the cell phone, he bails, and the dwarves and Bilbo, by the way, by cell phone call, I mean like Galadriel like psychically like just calls him, right?
Yeah, that was like a Aquaman moment.
Yes. So he gets his psychic cell phone call, leaves, and then the dwarves and Bilbo conveniently are left at the front door of the cursed forest, and they have to enter the forest to make their way through it, to get to the lake, to get to the Lonely Mountain. They're taking the most direct route possible because of these orcs that are on their heels.
And here, this is one of my favorite parts of the movie. I thought they did, first off, a really good job of the dwarves pathfinding. Like, it wasn't easy. They're like, oh, here's Yellow Brick Road, let's follow that. It was difficult on them, and they had to double back, and it took all of them, and they had to be aware. I thought that was very well done.
Yeah, like actually showing them trying to negotiate the, what's that fancy word you use? Ensorcelled paths.
Ensorcelled path, yes.
Yes, of Mirkwood. And, of course, they end up finding themselves tangled up with some spiders.
Well, even before that, I also liked how the oppressive nature of the Mirkwood itself was like screwing with them. It was like a drug trip.
Actually, you know what? Yeah, I'm gonna give some accolades here as well. Mirkwood seemed like the confusing, oppressive is a good word, mess that I imagined it to be. Like, I remember reading about that. And I was like, oh God, I just want them out of here. I just want them out of here. And when Bilbo pops up above the canopy for a breath of fresh air and a look around, the relief, in addition to the cool butterflies floating and the wonderful leaves swaying in the wind, the sense of relief is palpable. And you're like, oh, wow, I would never want to go back down there. But, you know, he's up in the canopy. He spies Erebor. He sees the lake. He sees their path before them. And he's calling down to his dwarf and companion saying, hey, this is the way we need to go, when he notices some rustling in the trees approaching. And then we end up with a spider situation. So far, we've got a weird flashback thing going on. We've got like a little bit of a departure, but I'm not too angry or anything. Like, we're making our way through Mirkwood. Here come the spiders, right?
They're earning some good points with Mirkwood.
Right. So wackiness ensues, and Bilbo and the company find themselves the captives of these spiders, and Bilbo has to free his friends using his ring of power, the ring he took from Gollum in the first movie, which we know is the One Ring from the trilogy. And if you don't know that, it basically reads its dark speech inscription to you every time he puts it on. So if you don't know that,
you're not paying attention.
Right. Like every time, like Ashkalachavla, like whatever that dark speech inscription is that Sauron writes on the ring, you know, which is the whole One Ring to rule them all spiel. Every single time he puts that ring on, it starts talking. So that is the One Ring, just to let you know. It's pretty cool, though. When he puts it on, he hears the spiders chattering in dark speech, like, feed, feed, which I thought was pretty cool. Do you agree?
Yeah. And I really like the inclusion of those little things. I mean, the spiders were pretty damn menacing without understanding what they were saying. You kind of got the gist, but that was something that was important to be included.
Yeah, I thought that was awesome. So with the cool sequence of him hearing them and being invisible to the spiders out of the way, he then, thanks to the invisibility granted by his ring, frees his friends, murders a millipede, which happens too close to the ring that he drops in the ensuing melee.
That is when they just lost me.
He full-on golems out, right? He's only had the ring for a short time. And as we know, the ring only corrupts him to a certain point in all the years he has it.
He's had the ring for 24 hours at this point. He will bear it for 80 more years, and he is filled with murderous, slobbering rage at the thought that someone else will be near it. It was a mindless creature. It wasn't going to put it on. It wasn't going to wear it. It wasn't trying to take it from him. It was near the ring.
Right. This giant millipede creature's legs passed kind of near the ring, and Bilbo just lost it and brutally just slaughtered this creature. If he'd gotten out of the way, the thing probably just would have crawled by, right?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it basically, like, poked its head out its door to see what all the hubbub was.
And Bilbo murdered it. So he murders this poor creature and then takes the ring back. Mine! Brr. But then I guess Jackson kind of has him realize, like, wow, I'm really freaking out over this ring a little too much. I better cool down for the next 80 years. Because he has a moment where he's like, he has a getting a grip moment where he calms down, puts the ring in his pocket, and then seems somewhat loath to use it for a while after that, you know?
Wipes the tick gore from his clothes.
Yes. And of course, I forgot to mention, in the spider battle, grants his sword the name Sting, because one of the spiders, like, exclaims that it stings when he stings them with it, which is from the book, although I don't remember it exactly happening like that.
Technically, it's what happened, but not how it happened. So close enough, I guess. A for effort.
Right. So Sting is named. The dwarves are freed. They're out of the clutches of the spiders for the most part, until
you have a 3-second breather to relax from action scene to action scene.
Right, and who comes swinging in but none other than Legolas from the Lord of the Rings trilogy.
And I'd just like to get this hatred started right now. His could-be, possibly would-be girlfriend, the oldest and most powerful Sylvan elf ever to walk the earth. The only, what are they called? What are the wood elves called? Yeah, the Sylvan Elves. The only Sylvan Elf to ever visit the Undying Land.
Now, your objection here, the evidence you have for her having visited the Undying Lands is the fact that, and we'll get to this in a minute, she seems to exhibit powers that only the Noldor should have. Is that correct?
It was kind of a big thing. Only the elves that personally viewed the tree glowed like that.
When they were using their healing arts and stuff, you mean, or just glowing in general?
Just glowing in general. I think the healing arts is like a representation of the glow, but...
Okay. Okay, so viewed the trees that were the former lights of the world before Melkor and Ungoliant destroyed them, right? Which is some Cimmerillion stuff that we can't really get into. Basically, Melkor, the guy who was Sauron's master and a spider who begat the likes of Shelob from the previous Lord of the Rings movie, destroyed those trees. But before that, the Noldor viewed them, right?
Right.
Okay.
All right. The most ancient, most powerful of the Noldor, like two of which still exist.
Galadriel's one, right? Is she not?
I believe she is.
And the... I remember they destroyed the trees. That was one affront. And then the reason that the Noldor chased Melkor back into Middle-earth, and we're getting way into like pre-Hobbit stuff here, was because they were in pursuit of the Cimmerils, which were jewels that had some of the juice from like the magic pools that fed those trees or some such thing like that. We're way off the beaten path, though, so let's get back on track.
But yes, because she glows later in the film, it's canonical evidence that she viewed the trees, which no Sylvan elf ever did.
Okay. All right.
Bug me. Had to mention it. I'll get over it now.
Okay. No problem. So this made up, completely fabricated for the film character named Tauriel is accompanying Legolas, and she and Legolas show up and take the dwarves prisoner. Legolas is kind of a jerk.
Legolas is also fat and old.
I couldn't help but notice how round Legolas' face looked. Is that just like makeup in combination with him being a little bit older now, the actor?
I have no idea. It cleared up in the rest of the film, which really confused me. Like, it was just a bad shot or something, dude.
Just unflattering angle. Anyway, so a somewhat more portly-looking Legolas shows up. Not that I'm anyone to talk, but shows up with this made-up Tauriel creature. They take the hobbits prisoner. They bring them into the forest realm of King Thranduil, who is Legolas's father. I can forgive Legolas's appearance because Thranduil is his father. So yeah, I guess it kind of makes sense he would be there. He wasn't in the book. I'm willing to let that go. The Tauriel thing, I have no explanation for.
If she had just been one of the hosts or something like that, like she had just shown up, like, oh yeah, I work here. Okay. But she was clearly more powerful than Legolas.
Right. And yet still there's a little scene where Thranduil tells her that he will never let his son marry a lowly Sylvan elf like her.
Even though she's thousands of years old and witnessed the creation of the universe firsthand.
I'm going to have to look that up. I don't know enough about ancient Tolkienic lore to know what... I know that the Noldor did go to Valinor with the Valar, who were like the demigods or angels that sort of look over Middle-earth. And so they gained extra powers, right?
Yes.
Yeah, so whatever. She's not one of them, and yet she seems to exhibit those powers per the movie's sort of rules for demonstrating those powers. So we'll get to that in a little while. Anyway, King Thranduil comes out, and he's a real jerk.
Which I liked, because he was. He was very, like, fuck the dwarves. I'm not risking any more elves. We got it bad enough.
Yeah, he was very about protecting his own realm and would only help Thorin to the extent that Thorin might return certain jewels which are in the vast hoard of treasure that Smaug guards in Erebor. I really did like, there was a little touch in and among all of the crazy David Bowie like swaying and grand gestures and everything that he was doing when he mentioned those jewels. And for the life of me, I can't remember what they specifically are, if anything, from the book. His eyes actually, like little sparkles appear in his eyes, which I thought was kind of cool. I don't know if you noticed that.
I did not notice his eyes twinkling. Yeah, he's watching his snake charming shoulders a little too closely.
Yeah, so it was pretty cool. He demanded a boon in exchange for helping Thorin reclaim the mountain by letting him go and whatever, possibly giving him provisions. That wasn't really mentioned. Thorin flatly refuses because he's still mad because the elves didn't go charging into Erebor, I guess, at the beginning of the first movie to like take on Smaug. So he's really mad at the elves at this point and refuses flatly and gets locked up in his cell again.
Thranduil wanted the Arkenstone too, didn't he? Which is evidence of Thorin's covetousness already taking effect.
Okay, could be. I mean, he doesn't ask for it in that scene. I know later the Arkenstone is sort of used as a bargain. This isn't going to be in the third movie. I don't really want to give that away. But in the book, I know the Arkenstone is used kind of as a bargaining chip, I think, to bring the good armies to some accord. But or something along those lines. I'm going to have to reread the book. I really should have done that. But Thorin, in his like greed and hatred, just doesn't see any kind of reason and won't help Thranduil and won't hear of any help coming from Thranduil. So he gets locked up. And he completely puts all his faith in Bilbo and his ability to free the dwarves from the elven prison. And he has good reason to trust Bilbo, because Bilbo proves once again to be a very competent burglar and sneak thanks to the power of his ring.
Before we move on, let's talk about Dragonfire.
Oh, I'm so sorry. Okay, I don't know if there's any Cimmerillionic, if that's a word, evidence for this. But apparently Thranduil bears some ancient wounds from fighting some of Melkor's dragon creations in the far north. And he, in his wrath, exposes this wound in a sort of CG morphing scene where his left cheek like peels back to reveal sinew and muscle and some gaping wound.
So straight out of Harvey Dent.
He did really look like Harvey Dent. Yes, he did. So he's Two-Face, and apparently a dragon can really mess up the cheek of an elf. But but he was doing that because he wanted to let Thorin know that he knew what it was like to face dragons and something or other. Whatever. So they're mad, and the dwarves are in jail, and then Bilbo is sneaking around with his ring on and gets to the wine cellar of Thranduil's kingdom, where the barrels are sent back to Lake Town for refilling or something like that. I don't remember exactly what the trade arrangement is, but this is from the book. Bilbo comes up with a plan that he's going to smuggle the dwarves out in these barrels. And so he does. He gets the keys off the drunken guardsmen and loads the dwarves in the barrels in a somewhat funny scene, and like opens this trapdoor and drops them all out into a river. And this was kind of funny. Does all this and completely neglects to look after himself. So there he is standing with no barrel and elf Tauriel for some reason, and the other elves coming to get him. And there's a kind of comic scene where he's shuffling around trying to figure out how the heck to get away before he himself falls down the trapdoor into the underground river.
Again, our 3-second respite before the next action scene ensues.
Right. I liked the slowing down, and I didn't mind the dialogue between Thranduil and Thorin, or the jail scenes. I didn't mind any of it. Oh, also forgot to mention that Tauriel and the attractive dwarf Kimli. Is that his name? Kimli? No, Keeley.
Keeley. The tall one.
The tall one, right?
Mr. Tall and Handsome.
Mr. Dwarvish Tall and Handsome. They have like a nice flirty scene, so I guess they're trying to imply there's a romance going on there. That happens while the dwarves are in jail. But now
you didn't check me for weapons.
Oh, God.
I can have anything in my pants.
I forgot about that. Okay, I'll admit that was pretty cheesy. I could have anything in my trousers is his pickup line. And it works. She finds him very attractive. I'm going to try that one. I'm going to have an attractive cop pull me over, a female cop, and hey, I could have anything in my trousers, and see if I end up with her number. Anyway, so now they're escaping in the barrels, and the elves know they're escaping, and so they blow the horn to close the gate, but then suddenly the attack squad of orcs appear, and there's this huge melee, and it's chaos, and you've got this, the beginning of this whole, like, I thought, really drawn out and needlessly, like, silly action scene with Legolas and Tauriel and orcs on the banks of the river fighting and jumping back and forth between barrels and top of dwarves and all this stuff as they make their escape from Thranduil's realm. I don't even know what to say first about this kind of needless scene, in my opinion.
So in the book, this was a quiet time for reflection. Bilbo had just sealed his friends in airtight containers and floated them on a rocky, rapid river, possibly killing them all. Concerned that he was responsible for the demise of the quest.
Or, hear me out for this alternative take on what happened. Or, Legolas is literally standing on the dwarf's head while shooting orcs with his bow. That was cool too, right? Right?
And then they get to the water gate, and they have to open it. So he gets out, and it's Mr. Handsome Dwarf, right?
all the bits I mentioned with Legolas dancing on the dwarves' heads, it's after they get out of the water gate, right? They have to get out of the Dwarven Kingdom. So they get to the water gate, and it's closed. So go on.
So they get to the water gate, and elves are standing guard. What are they going to do about the elvish guards? Well, luckily, the orcs show up and slaughter them.
Right, right. Elves are normally very competent slayers of orcs. But I guess the Keystone cops were on duty on this day. And the orcs catch them completely unaware and, like, slaughter them.
The orcs scale the walls that they're defending like nothing, asking you why they installed walls in the first place. Slaughter the guard without taking a single casualty.
Right. Only when Tauriel and Legolas show up do the tide of battle turn in favor of good. And they start fighting the orcs, and so Keeley gets out of his barrel and goes and pulls the lever to open the water gate so they can make good their escape, only to be shot in the leg by,
you know, some dwarf, by some orc, an orc 01, who just happens to have a mortal arrow. One of the nine personally took an interest in this orc and gave him a Morgul weapon.
Morgul weapons, as you know, are magicked with dark spells such that they cause like a form of like necrosis and eventually like withering away into a wraith of some sort, right?
You become a ring wraith, I believe.
Right.
Obviously one of lesser power, but yeah, you would have joined them in their world, which is...
I mean, if it works anything like the sword... That's how it goes. It seems to be poisoning Keeley going forward. But yeah, he gets nailed in the leg with this Morgul arrow that they brought with them for some reason. And nevertheless, is able to activate the gate and they escape. And then all the zaniness I mentioned before ensues with the dancing on the heads and the crazy like trick shots with the arrows and all the funny silliness. And I believe there are more than a few scenes of Tauriel and Legolas doing melee kills with arrows in hand.
Don't forget the barrel berserker.
And, right, I never do remember the names of the dwarves, even when I read the book. What's the big portly dwarf's
Cherbane.
Name? Sure. Cherbane. There's this really ridiculous slapstick scene where his barrel gets bounced up on the shore, and, of course, since he's such a big guy, he's got a lot of momentum, and he's mowing down a bunch of orcs. All right, that was funny. If it had dropped back in the river and that had been the end of it, that would have been one thing. But no, the barrel, like, rights itself up on its end, and his arms and legs pop out, and he becomes, like, a whirling dervish of axes, slaughtering dozens of orcs and before popping back into the river.
And then being buoyant. Holes in the barrel.
Well, no, he jumps into another barrel that was empty.
Oh, they have a spare?
Yeah, barrels seem to come and go during this scene as needed, so there was a spare, and he jumps in that, and they continue their way down the river, and then they get away. Still pursued by the orcs, they're still pursued by the elves, Legolas and Tauriel, and off they go to Lake Town, right?
The outskirts of Lake Town, where they chance upon Bard the Bowman.
Right, right. Sorry, I forgot all about that. Right.
So-called because he happens to own a bow.
I don't know what that has to do with anything, because it's not like he's going to use it. So they happen upon Bard, who is a character from the book, and Bard's going to get them into Lake Town, which is locked down and ruled over by some petty lord called the Master, remember from the book. Do you?
Yeah, no, he doesn't exist.
Okay, so the Master is this evil ruler of Lake Town, and Bard's going to sneak them in. So he smuggles the dwarves in as cargo, burying them in fish. Some comedy ensues with the dwarves being buried in fish and so on.
That's cute kind of comedy. I'm okay with including it. They didn't really say how they got into the town, so I don't mind that so much. Because I'm trying to find positives here. That was fun.
Right, right. So Bard, after being hassled by the Master's little henchman, Toady, like tax collector guy, basically a guy who's kind of analogous to Wormtongue from the original Lord of the Rings trilogy, if you remember that character.
I'd just like to point out, so at the moment we have Bard the Bowman, who's played by Inigo Montoya.
Yes.
We have the Master, who's played by the Goblin King from the first one. And we have Wormtongue, played by, I don't know, Wormtongue.
Sure. Or close enough facsimiles that it's hard to tell them apart. So, right. They're in Lake Town, and then there's this whole thing where I guess Bard is some kind of rabble rouser trying to stir the people of Lake Town up and like get them interested in democracy, and the master doesn't like that, and so Bard's like a criminal, and the dwarves are fugitives and blah blah blah. Bard makes a deal with the dwarves to provide them some weapons and see them on their way in exchange for all the payment. So in addition to getting them into Lake into the town, he was going to provide them some weapons and see and send them on their way. That was the deal. Well, the weapons he has are, of course, these improvised weapons that he has to keep out of sight of the master and his goons, lest they be seized. So they're
like
these
a chair leg, a rusty gaff.
They're definitely improvised weapons, right? Like fishing implement turned into weapons. And the dwarves are not satisfied. And Bard mentions that the only place you're going to find weapons is in the armory. You'll never get in there. So the dwarves, of course, make a beeline for the armory as soon as they can.
Forming a loving dwarven pyramid. I thought that was a nice touch.
Oh, you, how they get into the armory, you mean?
Yes.
Yeah, the audience found that very funny. They, of course, run up each other's backs to get in the armory to steal their weapons. While they're doing that, Bard runs down to the local tabard maker's shop, I guess, and finds a, I don't know what that was, a quilt or something that had, like, the line of Doran's people, in other words, the dwarves on it, and realizes that Thorin is the heir of Erebor, and the prophecy is true, and they're here to reclaim their homeland.
The prophecy which the master made, because it only exists when he exists, apparently.
Right, right.
There is no prophecy.
Well, be that as it may, Bard is alarmed because this prophecy foretells that when Thorin comes to reclaim his kingdom, it's going to spell the end of Lake Town. And I call it Lake Town, but it actually also has a proper name that I can never remember. Sort of an E, Esgarth or something like that. I don't remember. But so he's alarmed and runs back to stop the dwarves who he has hiding in his house, only to find that they've already made their way to the armory. One thing leads to another. Of course, they hand the weapons they're intending to smuggle to the Morgul injured Keeley, who drops them. Next thing you know, they're all under arrest and standing before the master. And they win the master over to their cause by letting him know that he and the entire city will share in the riches of their kingdom once they defeat the dragon Smaug and make their way in. And pretty much that wins him over Bard's objection, and they are sent off with much fanfare. And so the entire company leaves.
Much fanfare and Mongol trappings.
And wearing Mongol armor, yes. And I remembered something just now. The entire company doesn't leave. Half of it basically stays behind. I think Boffer is asleep, drunk, and Keeley is poisoned, and a couple others stay behind.
His brother stays to protect them. Someone stays to administer healthcare.
Boffer's asleep, and his brother is the singer from Nickelback, who stays with him. Right. So, by the way, am I the only one that got that?
I did not notice that.
He looks like the singer from Nickelback, totally. Who I do not like, by the way. Anyway, so they stay behind, and the remaining company and Bilbo go onto the mountain.
And I don't exactly remember when. But at some point during all of this, they peer out a window and they happen to notice what's called a windlance.
Yes.
What, you might wonder, is a windlance?
A windlance, right. I don't remember at what point they did notice that, but it was being explained to Bilbo that a windlance is basically a dwarven artillery piece that shoots these massive arrows meant for, I guess, slaying dragons, because I can't think of any other practical use for a windlance.
Massive black iron arrows.
Right.
To pierce the impierceable thick hide of the dragon instead of one amazing archer with black fletched arrows to pierce the one weak point that is not covered in hide. So basically, a completely different story.
Right. So basically, a windlance is this very nice scorpion, if you will, if you remember that sort of, what, medieval or Roman era giant crossbow device. And it's told that Bard's ancestor failed to stop Smaug, even after he exhausted the city of Dale's supply of windlances trying to shoot the beast. And so Bard and his family have never lived that down, and hence the humans have come to live in this wretched lake town, a mere shadow of the glory that was Dale, completely bereft of their pride and all the wealth flowing from Erebor. So you can see why they were more than happy to send Thorin on his way to let the good times roll again. But now we know that there's a Windlance, and that's obviously how Bard's going to end up killing Saug at some point or something, right?
I'm afraid so. We'll find out.
All right. So now I want to just talk about what goes on in the mountain, because everything that goes on in Lake Town from this point forward might as well just not have happened as far as I'm concerned.
Or as far as, you know, Tolkien's concerned.
Right. Let's get this bit out of the way. It happened simultaneously. But meanwhile, back in Lake Town, while all the cool stuff's going on in the Lonely Mountain, Tauriel and Legolas show up along with the orc ninja assassins. And there's a bunch of fighting that takes place, to include comical beheadings and all kinds of zaniness that the audience just completely loved. And Tauriel proceeds to heal Keeley using her magic healing arts. And here's where your objection comes in. As she's healing him and casting her elvish spells to heal his Morgul wound, she glows in a way that you're saying is reserved for the Noldor, because we saw Galadriel glow like that in the first trilogy, right?
Only some of the Noldor. Only those Noldor who were present at the trees.
Okay.
Who... Not even all the Noldor.
Okay. All right. So what I always thought that was just like when they cast their healing magics, they glowed. But if what you're saying is true, then Tauriel makes even less sense as a character. But right, she glows. And I will admit that the actress, when she is aglow and casting the spells and smiling, is quite comely. And it's easy to see why Keeley the dwarf is completely smitten with her. And after she uses her healing arts, he basically falls in love with her, and their hands touch, and it's a tender moment where they kind of like each other. And right, oh, and Legolas goes chasing off the evil orc leader, right?
We gotta give this more. We gotta give this more. Like, I know you wanna in the meantime, but the impenetrable fortress of a town that the dwarves had to be smuggled in fish-filled barrels, the Yellow Brigade just like climbs over the wall and leaps from house to house. Like, how do the orcs even get in?
Orcs are highly competent all of a sudden. I don't really know how they did any of this stuff. And by the way, I forgot to mention this. Oh God, there's so much. I'm purposely leaving out all the Dol Guldur stuff. The awkwardly inserted Azog the Defiler from the previous movie, who was pulled out of the pages of the Silmarillion and inserted into this movie. He's too busy doing other things to engage in this pursuit, so some other made-up orc is leading this troop of elite orc assassins. I just want to point that out. What's his name? Bulgor? Bulgar? Bulg something or other. Anyway, he and his team were able to infiltrate Lake Town, and I am a little puzzled as to how that came to be. I'm also puzzled as to how Lake Town's guards just weren't even on duty that day. Like, not one human guard appears to, like, stop these intruders.
Well, they gave all their Mongol armor to the heroes, so they didn't have armor to go out on patrol with.
Right. Yeah, that was a weird omission to me, but I was so completely just overwhelmed with what was going on that I didn't really think about it until later. Anyway, it ends up with Legolas chasing the orc across a huge, like, causeway that just goes from the lake to the mainland.
So after Legolas single-handedly fought back an orcan brigade without, like, messing up his hair, he goes one-on-one with this orc and comes out with a bloody nose, and the orc doesn't have a scratch.
Right, right. This orc more or less almost bests him.
It is the first time in his life he's been bloodied. He is confused by it. He touches his cheek and doesn't know what to make of the red stuff.
Right, 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 right. He can't believe he's been bloodied. So off rides the orc leader on his warg, and Legolas rides off in pursuit on this massive causeway that anybody could have just walked into Lake Town on. By the way, completely unguarded, I'd like to point out. And Keeley and what's-her-face Tauriel are, like, kind of in love now. And now, do we have all that Lake Town crap out of the way?
One more thing, because this is what got me so incensed. They beat this to death in the movies. If you'll remember, when Aragorn is trying to save Bilbo from a Morgul blade, he says to Sam, "Do you know the Atheles herb?" And Sam goes, "Aye, it's a weed." He says, "Go pick it." And in this movie, they say, "Do you have any Atheles?" And they're confused. Why do you want that utter fucking worthless piece of shit weed? We just give it to the pigs. Why do people commonly refer to that as a weed? Because its healing powers are only strong in the hands of a king or this dumb elf.
Oh, is that a fact? So Only a king or...
It's called King's Foil!
Right, King's Foil, duh, yeah, right. So only, like, the elves or, like, Aragorn could really make use of its power, or Tauriel for some reason.
I'm quoting this now. According to folklore in Gondor, it is especially powerful in the hands of the king, perhaps because of the elven heritage of the royal house.
Right, because they have elven blood, right? And I think Aragorn's name is, what, Elend? Doesn't he have, like, an elvish name or something?
Yeah.
Anyway, okay, so...
So all of a sudden, any schmuck elf can use it.
The thing is, because Tauriel was completely made up, she can basically embody anything Jackson wants. Like, she can, like, cast, like, lightning bolts at Smaug in the next movie if he wants. And...
There's no royal blood, or there wouldn't be a problem with her courting Legolas.
Right, but you'll see, it's going to turn out that she's some kind of a lost elvish princess, and she and Legolas are going to get married. Like, they're going to do, like, an extra scene at the end of the next release of The Lord of the Rings on disc, where they're getting married or something.
I think we're done with Lake Town, finally. Wait, one more thing. I would like, in the spirit of giving props to what is not terrible about the film, at least when they had to cut Keeley's pants off for them to get at the wounded leg, they didn't make the, yeah, finally got in my pants joke.
Oh, God, yes. That would have been the logical Hollywood follow-on to, why don't you search my trousers? So they didn't. I'm sure it was in there and it got cut. It'll be in the extended edition.
Now we can move on.
Okay, yes. God, let's. All right, I really want to get to the Lonely Mountain now and scenes that I thought were strong for the most part. But I also have to mention that when Gandalf left the company after getting Galadriel's cell phone call, he went with Radagast, whose expanded role in the first movie I didn't mind so much, but who is starting to wear on me now a little bit, to look for evidence that the Nazgul had been revived by visiting their tombs in the High Fells. And they found that evidence. So the Nazgul are back. And if the Nazgul are back, that must mean that the Dark Lord himself, Sauron, has come back in some capacity. So confirm that, Radagast and Gandalf journey to Dol Guldur.
Radagast, who is a completely, utterly failure of a wizard, because he became so fascinated by the animals that he did nothing to assist in the war effort.
Correct. He ended up... I mean... Maybe if it had come to it, he would have defended the animals. You know what I mean? I don't know if that was his role. Wasn't one of the Valar like a nature spirit or something who like liked animals and trees and shit? I don't know. I'm thinking maybe he served her. I'm trying to justify Radagast's failure, but regardless, he does.
Bunnies are cute. Bunnies are cute. I get it. That's why he failed. But in the book, he failed. He didn't lift a finger for the war effort.
Right, he's like one step up from the Blue Wizards in that he's at least involved kind of at the periphery, whereas the Blue Wizards just like, were they really blue or were they different colored? I don't even remember that.
No, I think they were blue. They were blue and they just walked off into the sunset.
Yeah, they just went off and did their own thing, like when we're never heard from again. Like they played no part. But Radagast played very little part, but he's got this expanded role. So now he and Gandalf go to Dol Guldur and... Gandalf makes Radagast go, what, carry a message to Galadriel, or was it to Elrond?
Yeah, apparently they were in a dead zone.
Yeah, I don't. Why didn't he just cell phone call her? I don't get that.
I think he was trying to get rid of Radagast so that, depending on how negative an outlook you want to take, so that he could either protect Radagast from the dangers, or so that Radagast could burst into Dol Guldur on his bunny sled and save Gandalf in the next film.
Well, that latter scenario could be something we're looking at in the third film, because Gandalf enters Dol Guldur and casts his, like, dispel invisibility spell a few times, and the illusion that Dol Guldur is this abandoned ruin fades with each casting of the spell, and finally the vastness of the host gathered there is revealed. And no sooner does Gandalf cast the spell for the last time than... What's his face again?
Azog.
Azog the Defiler and his goons jump out, and there's a fight scene. And Gandalf pretty easily handles them with his magic, confirms that there is, in fact, a huge orcish host, and then, using some magic to evade the orcs, proceeds to try to escape from Dol Guldur, only to be confronted by a evil black malice given an amorphous form known as Sauron.
That's right. Sauron himself confronts Gandalf one-on-one.
Yes, they have a one-on-one magic battle. The cloud form that is Sauron, having gathered some of his strength, eventually overpowers Gandalf's spheres of light and then pins him up against the wall and burns his staff and then casts a pretty cool Bakshi-inspired special effect, like a strobe light effect, where... See, it's a proto-eye, the eye from the Lord of the Rings. It's the eye, but in the center, what would be the iris is him standing there in his armor. See what happened there?
And his very tall, like, long form. I kind of like that. But you so brushed over, he burns Gandalf's staff to ashes, thereby breaking all his power on Earth.
Oh, is the staff the source of his power?
That's what happened when Gandalf disowned Saruman. He broke his staff.
I guess he must have a backup staff somewhere, because he's got no staff, and by the end of it, he is in a crow cage dangling over the forest, and the orcish army is shown to be on the march. And then that's the last we see from Dol Guldur, right?
Yes.
Fine. Okay, there we go. Done with Lake Town, done with Dol Guldur. Let's get to Erebor. Let's get to the Lonely Mountain. So they get there. They make it by the last light of Durin's day. The sun sets. They're in the appointed spot at the appointed time, and the dwarvish door does not reveal itself. So Thorin and company just like, yeah, we're out of here, and leave in disgust, leaving Bilbo to puzzle over for a couple more minutes what might have gone wrong. And of course, the moon comes out, and it's a full moon, and the last light of Durin's day turns out not to be the setting sun, but rather the full moon. Duh. And the keyhole to the hidden door is revealed, and Thorin and company show up. Thorin gets there just in time to keep Bilbo from accidentally kicking the key over a ledge. And then next thing you know, they're inside the Lonely Mountain again. They're inside the Kingdom of Erebor.
And the only defensible reason for She-Elf to be in the film is revealed, because she wouldn't shut the fuck up about moonlight the entire film.
Oh, really? Was she foreshadowing things with moonlight the whole time?
You remember how she wanted to see the true light of the night sky and how it was really more powerful than the sun? And
oh, God. I was really kind of not paying attention to her the whole time, but all right. Sure. There you go. So she existed to let you know about the power of moonlight. Apparently Jackson's a Sailor Moon fan. I don't know. Now, once they enter Erebor, there's a brief scene, which I thought was really well done. Imagine having been denied your home for so long, and now finally you're within its walls again. Balin, the old warrior who's sort of Thorin's right-hand man, actually tears up a little bit. And Thorin is like just kind of touching the walls. Oh, I know these walls. This is my home. That was kind of a touching scene, I thought.
Yeah. I thought them actually being back inside was kind of a big deal to them. That played very well to the audience. Good part.
And after getting in, they see an inscription over the exit door for some reason, which...
The secret, no one knows about this, no one can ever know about this, because then our defenses would be pointless. Exit door, clearly labeled.
Has a big inscription over it that lets all the dwarvish folk know that they should serve the king under the mountain, because he rules by the right of the Arkenstone, which is depicted, and Bilbo sees that in the inscription. He's like, hey, what's that? Oh, that's the Arkenstone. And then Balin lets him know that's what he's there to get, and sends him down into Smaug's lair to retrieve the Arkenstone. After a bit of a funny exchange where he cautions Bilbo not to wake up the sleeping dragon, and then proceeds to like disappear outside. That was kind of funny. And next thing you know, Bilbo's entering the mountain. And after some dumb cutscenes back to Dol Guldur and Lake Town, which you've already gotten out of the way, he makes his way down into the vast sea of gold wherein Smaug lies buried, and proceeds to look for the Arkenstone, which is buried somewhere amidst that vast hoard, and proceeds to wake Smaug up by bumbling around. And then I think some of the most awesome parts of the movie ensue, that where Smaug is actually awake and having dialogue and stuff, in my opinion. Do you agree?
To a point. It goes south real fast. But yeah, at the moment, it's good.
Right. You dread Smaug waking up. You dread Bilbo disturbing him. But of course, eventually he does, and Bilbo slips on his ring to evade Smaug. And you got Smaug. The voice was excellent. Smaug was very well done on all levels.
Smaug looked amazing. He was a little on the Kelsey Grammer side for me. I didn't really love that. He was a very proper dragon.
But he spoke well in the book, did he not? He wasn't like a...
He was well spoken. I didn't really get snob out of him.
I got arrogant out of him.
Yeah, I could totally get arrogant, yeah.
So he hunts for Bilbo, and he's looking for him and sniffing around, and...
The banter's great. The banter was perfect.
Right, except for the part where he identifies Bilbo as wearing the ring by mentioning that he's wearing something precious. Which is, of course, an allusion back to Gollum's name for the ring, the Precious.
Oh, and of course the fact that the dragon that has been sleeping in complete and utter solitude for 40 years knows all about Sauron returning and gathering forces in Dol Guldur.
Yeah, so during the course of this conversation and all the events that take place afterwards, Smaug is revealed to have like a very keen knowledge of what's been going on in the world while he slumbered under the Lonely Mountain during his reign as king under the mountain, if you want to put it that way. I chalk that up to his being kind of godlike and having like a knowledge of things beyond himself, you know what I mean? A sort of limited omniscience, I guess. Does that make sense?
I really like to pretend that the thrush is just walking around whispering ears into everyone, just trying to start shit.
The thrush is like a triple agent. So for listeners who don't know, the thrush is the little bird who actually, in the book, tells Bard the Bowman where Smaug's weak point is, correct, Brian?
Yes, he points out the missing scale.
Right. But in this movie, after Smaug reveals all his vast grandeur to show himself off to Bilbo, Bilbo sees the loose scale. I guess he's going to end up revealing that to Bard or one of Radagast's rabbits is, or maybe Toriel will, or Legolas, or maybe the master will be redeemed and he'll reveal it. Who knows? Anything could happen. I will say there's one funny part of dialogue in all this where Bilbo lets Smaug go, "Hey, I'm not here to rob you. I just came here to confirm that you're basically as majestic as all the tales said." And then he like squeaks out, "Because I did not believe them." He's like, yeah. I thought that was pretty humorous because he was obviously horrified.
Yeah.
And then Smaug like wheels around this huge pillar and just reveals himself in all of his grandeur. And it's damn impressive. Like, he's a really cool looking character. There, I was very worried about a Sean Connery like Dragonheart experience. But that did not happen, thankfully.
No, the dragon was amazing. The model was just unreal. Moved well. Even his weird accent wasn't terrible. Just right. Kind of. I was looking for stuff to bitch about at this point. I mean,
well, you didn't need to look much farther, because soon after, Thorin and the gang enter the Lonely Mountain again. Because Bilbo, having, in my opinion, it doesn't show it, but I know from the book he should have the Arkenstone on his person. Is trying to make an exit while Smaug is hunting for him.
All right, all you.
And on his way out, he is confronted by Thorin, who asks him, "Hey, you got the Arkenstone?" And he hesitates. And he hesitates, I think, because during his dialogue with Smaug, Smaug reveals that he wouldn't mind Thorin getting his hands on the Arkenstone so it could drive him mad, apparently implying that if he did have the Arkenstone, it would only make him more greedy and single-minded. So my read on that is Bilbo wants to spare Thorin the madness and the inducement to greed that the Arkenstone would be.
Yeah, I think he was trying to protect him a little.
Yeah, and when he saw like the greed in his eyes, he was really taken aback. He's like, "I'm going to wait and see before I let you know I have this thing." And that wasn't helped by the fact that next thing he knew, Thorin's sword point was like stuck in his chest. And the only thing that I think kept Thorin from running him through was the fact that Smaug came around the corner at that point.
Also, don't really remember that from the book.
Yeah, I don't remember Thorin being so driven by greed that he was like on the verge of homicide. So around the corner comes Smaug, and it's pretty cool, and then the dwarves all come bursting in to like get to be at their king's side, and Smaug lets loose with some fire. By the way, the fire breathing is awesome.
I love the glowing scales as the fire ascends his throat.
Yeah, it's
very cool.
You see this furnace light up in his belly, yeah, and the flames make their way up through his throat. It's really cool. And then Smaug proceeds to chase them all around, and they try to escape the mountain. They find this final resting place of a bunch of their dead kin who also tried to escape the Lonely Mountain. Thorin resolves not to die in such a pathetic way and hatches a really weird, convoluted plan that involves taking Smaug to the furnaces, because apparently there was a big public works project in progress on the day Smaug took over the Lonely Mountain, and Thorin hatches this plan to use that against Smaug. So,
cue Davy Jones music.
Yes.
They break up yet again. Three of them run off that way, Smaug following hot on their tails, until three of them break off the other way and taunt him, confusing the dragon, who forgets about his original quarry and decides to chase them. Then they start running from pillar to pillar, evading him, him looking more and more confused, more and more frustrated. I honestly expected them to just, like, do the whole Scooby-Doo, like, the hallway with the mini dwarves.
Yeah, you actually forgot they broke into three groups, and he turns his attention from one to the other. I really was expecting at one point for Thorin to, like, come running out from behind a pillar with Smaug on his back and Bilbo chasing them.
Yeah.
Zany. But Smaug, like, chases them all throughout their former kingdom, and they make their way to the forge, and Thorin insults Smaug and gets him to relight the forges, and they all burst to life, and all of a sudden, these rivers of gold start to flow. And after that, they lower Smaug into this giant hall called the Hall of Kings or Hall of Ancestors or something like that.
After Thorin goes surfing.
I'm sorry. After Thorin takes a wheelbarrow and goes surfing on a river of gold into this Hall of Kings, he has his kinfolk lure Smaug into that same hall. And then, as Smaug is really frustrated, he can't find the dwarves, he bursts into that hallway. He and Bilbo exchange a couple words. He's like, you know what? I've just worked it all out. You came from Lake Town, didn't you? Well, I'm going to teach you. I'm going to go burn Lake Town for having the arrogance to send these, you know, thieves into my domain, blah, blah, blah. And Bilbo's like, no, don't. And he's like, oh, you like those people in Lake Town, huh? Well, now you get to watch them burn. And so he turns around to go towards Lake Town. And then Thorin and the gang pipe up, and they're standing on top of this massive stone structure. It's hard to tell what it is. And Smaug comes back, and they exchange words, and Smaug's like, hey, I beat your army fair and square. This is my kingdom now. And Thorin's like, we're going to take our revenge on you. And then he cues his comrades, and they pull a bunch of ropes, and this big stony pile he was standing on turns out to be a giant cast for the ultimate public works project in honor of his vain grandfather, who I guess brought down the Wrath of Smaug in his greed. A massive golden statue. And all those rivers of gold have been pouring into this massive cast for this statue. And so when they pull away the cast, there is the statue standing before Smaug, who is transfixed by it for a moment. But of course, the statue hasn't had time to set up yet. So only the outer layer has sort of cooled. So it's got a molten core. And it just basically explodes, burying Smaug in a river of molten gold. The end. Or is it?
We're joking that that's the end, but I was so ready to believe that they actually just changed the story so much.
Right, that the dwarves killed him by burying him in gold?
That the dwarves killed him, period.
Right. I'm sorry, yes. Yeah, for a minute there, like, he was completely submerged in this pool of gold, and I'm like, oh no, this can't be, no way, I can't accept this. Thankfully, I mean, I've never been so glad to see a bad guy emerge from a precarious situation in my life. He bursts forth from this lake of gold in a rage. I'll show you revenge. And then goes bursting out of Erebor through the wall, providing the dwarves a convenient exit. And like takes off and like just sloughs off all the gold in a shower of gold. It looked kind of cool, I thought. Says, I am death or something like that.
And I was really hoping they were going to leave the gold on him. I thought that like Super Saiyan Smaug would be awesome.
Like layered in gold. Yeah, that would have been pretty cool. But basically, that's it. It cuts to black immediately as soon as he's said, you know, I am something, I am death, and then boom, it just cuts to black. I thought that was a very good abrupt ending. Of course, everybody in the theater was like, what? Hey, what's going on here? All three.
Time to throw popcorn.
Right. It was the same as when they threw popcorn at the first Lord of the Rings movie. Like, dude, it's a trilogy. Do you not know this? So that was it. That was the end of the movie. And
I felt for the first time just like Bilbo when he climbed above the trees and could breathe again. A butterfly fluttered by me in the theater. And it was 3D and the size of a mouse.
You were pretty... I gotta say, you sat through it, but you were very... Your reaction was exactly what I thought it was going to be to this movie. And every time you were like, oh my God, I can't take any more of this. I was like, wait for it. There's more. There's more. There's more. And until the very end of the movie, there was always more, wasn't there?
Yeah, yeah. The gold statue thing and him being like submerged in gold. And
Oh, man. Is there anything we missed? I mean, I think we pretty much captured like all the outrages in this. Like, why these additions? Why all this fast and loose treatment of the original story? Is that the only way to get three-hour movies out of that book?
I will answer those questions, both in turn. We did miss something. We missed the worst transgression of all. We missed the Family Guy joke. We missed Peter Jackson, who until this, I had a lot of admiration for. He lowered himself to the level of Family Guy. There is a point where they're surveying, and one of the dwarves points out, this is the remnants of the war. This is the desolation of Smog. Peter Griffin appears on screen and says, Roadhouse, and then goes away.
I remember right when he was going to say that, I held up my index finger, and then as soon as he said it, I pointed at the camera like, there it is. I could see you like just grimacing like, behold the ruins of Dale. Behold the desolation of Smaug. They should have put the title screen back up.
I expected a graphic. I expected like something to like really hammer you over the head with it.
Oh God, that was really dumb.
And to answer the second part of your question, I was reading a review of the film, and I think this guy hit it dead on. All the changes, all of the creations, just everything is in the movie to make it a wintertime summer blockbuster.
Really? Like all the essential elements are there?
All the essential elements are there, and the money grab is there. We need a film that is going to pack the audiences in and do this and do this. Not, we need a film that was ever faithful to the wonderful, majestic story of heart overcoming adversity and faith overcoming force, and we need money. Oh, and make up some ninja orcs so that we can sell action figures.
Oh boy. So it all came down to economics, like what's going to appeal most to a film audience.
That's really what the film felt like to me.
I mean, is it fair of us to expect anything other than that from a movie?
He made $1 billion off the first three, right?
So yes, it's fair. There were some changes, you know, from the books, but those weren't nearly the departure from the books that this movie was.
I really think that you could be happy with making $1 billion and still having a story about heart, as opposed to needing to make $1.5 billion and having another action, kung fu, wire fu, orc flying.
Man, I gotta say, I normally love an action movie. This was just way too much. Like, I was like, I had action fatigue by the end. Like, come on, no more fighting, please. I don't think The Matrix had this much fighting in it.
I have no answer. No. Half of those action scenes didn't take place and shouldn't have taken place.
Okay, and here's the final thing I think I want to touch on. At this point, what major players in Middle-earth don't know that Sauron, not the Necromancer, not some dark evil that they haven't identified, but Sauron himself is back?
The only ones that don't know are the young children and widowed wife of that poor mite who stepped outside to get the morning paper.
Who Bilbo murdered for the ring. Oh, hey, you drop it.
They were going to find out if he had gotten to return with the morning paper, but because Bilbo mercilessly ended his pitiful life, they are the only creatures in all of Middle-earth that don't know that Sauron is back.
Yeah, it feels like they're revealing that way too early. Like, I don't think until the Lord of the Rings trilogy started, Gandalf really knew that it was Sauron who had returned. And even in the movies, forget the books, even in the movies, it shows him researching in the vast library of, I believe, Minas Tirith to find out what's going on. Like, you know, I looked this up and it looks like this ancient evil has returned and your ring is the key, right?
I have discussed this in, apparently there's still a little bit of hope. Apparently the White Council confronted Sauron at Dol Guldur and simply thought they had vanquished him. They knew he came back, thought they had beaten him, and then weren't worried about him still being around.
Oh, per the Silmarillion? Or per the actual canon history, that's what happened?
We'll see. There's some hope that that's just not a complete departure.
I'm going to have to...
I still don't think they ever crossed swords with him.
They felt they had just prevented his return. Well, you know, I guess we'll have to see, because if that was definite, there were no bones about it. Like, Gandalf uttered the word Sauron as he was getting, like, totally wrecked by Sauron. So he's back, and he's got an army of orcs, and that army is going to play a role in the next movie, obviously. And I have a really bad feeling that because Smaug has not been dealt with in the way he is in the book at this point.
The Battle of Six Armies.
I think the big end battle at the end of The Hobbit is going to involve Smaug and Tauriel and made-up orcs and a bunch of stuff. You know what? I think the Treants are probably going to like make a... Or the
Entwides will show up?
Yeah, yeah. Because people love Treebear. They should put him in the movie, too. Yeah, have the Ents show up. And are we missing anybody? Well, the Eagles actually do show up. They should. But who else could come?
I think the Thrush is going to show up with like a Mongol hat and a weapon.
He was probably outfitted by the Master. I wonder what role the Master has to play going forward. Okay, one good thing. I'll end this on a good note. Did you happen to notice in one of the scenes that there was a statue of one of those Pukul men, or whatever they're called?
Oh, yeah, yeah. In one of the slower barrel scenes, correct?
I believe it's when they're treating with Bard to gain passage, but I don't know for sure.
Well, that was right after the barrel scene, so yeah, that would, yeah, yeah.
It was pretty cool that they actually showed that, and they didn't mention it. It was just sitting there in the background. Yeah. It was total like nod to the fans, like, hey, here's a Pukul Man statue.
Just like Tom, Dick, and Harry at Weathertop.
The trolls.
Yeah, the trolls at in the original trilogy.
I thought that was really well done, and then it tied into this movie, so it was great. Oh well, I am exhausted after talking about this movie. It has been mixed feelings. As a standalone movie, I like it. If it comes on cable next year, I'll probably watch it. But as a fan of the book, it's hard for me to see past all the glaring discrepancies.
You know, even the original, even Lord of the Rings had a lot of like pretty damning discrepancies. But I really thought the heart was there. I really thought he was trying to make the best movie he could, and he had to give a little. Like, I kind of understand why Aragorn had to confront the Mouth of Sauron instead of Gandalf just knocking him aside. Like,
totally dismissing him, right?
And, you know, the power of men rising and blah, blah, blah. That was symbolic and that was good, but I don't know, dude. It's the same to me as if Aragorn had, like, stepped up and kicked him in the nuts. And then his eyes are like, whoa! Like.
Yeah, this film was definitely not as enjoyable for me as the original, as The Unexpected Journey, which had its issues too, but man, was way just better in my opinion. I don't know what. It was truer to the feeling of the original book, you know what I mean?
Exactly, the feeling.
Well, here's hoping. He's got a third. Well, the third movie's done, right? I'm assuming he's done filming it already, or no?
I think they filmed at the same time. So yeah, they're just doing, I guess, post and, you know, holding it because this will make money for a long time.
So it's all of our criticism and the criticism of the web at large comes too late, right? Because it's already in the can.
Well, I mean, the only thing we could do is not see it. But yeah, it's been made, I think. I don't think they're going to change anything.
Let's be honest, though. We're going to go see the third movie.
Well, I'm going to go see episode 7, too, so...
That's where the bar's at right now. Well, here's hoping that the next movie, The Hobbit, I don't know what it's going to be called.
It'll probably be called The Battle of Five Armies or something like that, or Oh, it'll be called The Hobbit 3, The King Under the Mountain.
I like The King Under the Mountain. That's good. Okay, I hope that's the title for the last movie. But here's hoping it's better, and it's a good way to end this sort of stretching out and expansion on the original masterpiece that was The Hobbit.
Hobbit 3, Revenge of Smaug.
They could really get my goat by misusing the word decimate. The decimation of Smaug. You killed like 10% of him? No. All right, man. I guess that is a wrap for our episode. We should probably let our guests know about how they can listen to other episodes and interact with us.
And write us about all of the incredibly nitpicky things we were wrong about, because I'm sure there were some. My lore is not as strong as I'd like to think.
I know, but even with our like middling level of lore knowledge, we were able to pick apart quite a lot. So I'd really like to know what a true Tolkien has to say. So let us know. Drop us a line at nerdstravaganza@gmail.com. And as well, check out our website, nerdstravaganza.com. And of course, if you like what you heard here, feel free to subscribe to us on iTunes, write us a favorable review, and give us many, many, many stars when you rate us. And if iTunes is not your thing, or you want to look for a streaming alternative, check us out on Stitcher.
Don't forget to like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter and Instagram, plus one us on Google Plus. And if you're really into it, join our Super Nerd Secret Society through our Facebook group.
And until we see you in our group, I bid you a fond Middle Earth farewell.